Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Kavita Shanayan, and we're going to be talking about her new book, The Heart of Wellness, Bridging Western and Eastern Medicine to Transform Your Relationship with Habits, Lifestyle, and Health. Learn to transform your relationship using Dr. Shanayan's remarkable approach to health. The Heart of Wellness shows you how to break free of the false assumption that disease is something you need to fight. And instead, you'll explore the mind-body connection and your true nature so that you can end suffering and embrace the unlimited bliss of who you are. You'll begin by examining the nature of disease, the causative and risk factors, the role of diet, exercise, and medication, and how Eastern and Western medical practices can come together. You can find out more by visiting the website, which is kavitamd.com, and that's kavitamd.com. And I have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So welcome to the show, Dr. Shanayan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I enjoyed reading your book. I learned a whole lot that I had no idea was going on in my body. So.
No, that's wonderful. I am so gratified that you liked it.
I did. So I would like, you know, usually I like to start the show by having the guests give just a little bit of a background of their journey. So would you mind sharing with the listeners just a little bit about kind of the road you traveled a little bit, including the Eastern and Western contributions?
Yes, sure. I trained in Western medicine, went to medical school, and did the rest of my training and residency and cardiology fellowship and so on. And somewhere along the way, I had this epiphany because what had happened to me is something that probably familiar to a lot of people, which is that I was an overachiever and always looking for the next thing, and never satisfied with one thing. It's just like, okay, go to medical school, now I need this, now I need to go to the next level of training, now I need to do the next level of thing, and so on. Just during my, training in cardiology, I had this epiphany one day of, why is it that I'm not content? I mean, I have everything that I had always wanted. And yet I have this energy of seeking and searching for something more. And then it hit me that day that ultimately what I really was looking for is for that energy of speaking to come to an end. So like the end of speaking, and this is ultimately what everybody's seeking in the way we look at things. If I have this relationship, I'm going to be happy forever. If I have this job, that's it. My life is set. If I have this, I'm going to be fulfilled. And yet, we can get those things, and yet, that fulfillment doesn't last long. The contentment never lasts long. And that's like a common theme of just being human. So that really began my whole journey into looking into myself and began my inner journey and understanding that if I haven't found contentment permanently, then I'm looking in the wrong place. And excuse me. And that I need to be looking within, because I was an expert at looking everywhere else. And so that really began this whole, you know, inward journey. And then I started looking at my patients very differently, and thinking, well, you know, I can't really go to work and prescribe medicines and, you know, procedures and surgeries without really addressing this fundamental thing. And there was no language for me. There was no context in Western medicine to study this, you know, to study this this whole sense of who we are, who we think we are, and how that relates to our wellness and health and disease. So I turned to the Eastern, you know, medical sciences like Ayurveda. So I studied that. And, you know, it's beautiful. It opened up new avenues for me. And so I trained in that and still learning in it. So that's how this whole journey began.
Yeah, you know, that that constant search, you know, for happiness or bliss, which carries a big part of your book and program. You know, that is one thing that just seems to be human nature. You know, that constant search. And so now one of the things, I guess let's start with. You know, in the book, you indicate that the practices and principles in the book are about healing and not necessarily a cure. So, you know, when it comes to disease and sickness. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because, I it seems like, you know, the cure, you know, again, that endpoint seems to be the focus, you know, of so much pain and suffering and illness, that it's interesting that you make that distinction. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, when we talk about wellness, I think we're all kind of operating from a sense of fear. You know, I don't want that. I want it to be over. I just want it to be done, and so on. And somehow we connect that with our wellness and happiness and contentment. It's like, if that disease is there, then it must come with suffering. There is no way that you can have disease without actually suffering as a result of it. That's the common understanding of disease. You know, even in medical school, we kind of learn about disease and suffering as one and the same. But yes, mm-hmm. there are plenty of people who have no illness who are suffering. So
right.
Then there are those rare ones who have a chronic illness, incurable illness, and they're not suffering. So, you know, they are not one and the same. And so in terms of cure, we think that, you know, the wellness is going to be by curing the disease. And that is true to a certain extent, but healing has a very different connotation. You know, healing is about coming from that place of fear to a place of love. So that is the fundamental paradigm shift, is one of complete resistance and non-acceptance, and the other of being okay with what is. And so when I say this, it doesn't mean that we don't take medications, we don't do the necessary procedures, that it's one or the other. That's not at all what I'm saying. You know, we can be completely healed from within and yet need medications and need supportive therapies and so on. That doesn't mean that we're not healed. You see what I mean? Because healing goes to way beyond the body. It goes to the mind, the heart, the spirit, and connects us to that bliss, which is contentment and sweetness and fulfillment, no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. And You know, as I was going through and reading, you know, that those examples of people who have terminal illness, or yet seem to be not necessarily content, seem to accept it, and you know, don't let it kind of run their life. That there, you know, there is that sense of bliss. Now, your approach, and I love the term wealth, W-E-L-L-T-H, your approach to wealth, I thought that was very clever wordplay, wealth and illness is a path called Bliss Rx, or is it Bliss Rx or Bliss Prescription?
Yes, the Bliss Prescription.
Bliss Prescription. So the whole book is really kind of about that. But just on a high-level kind of overview, how would you describe the Bliss Prescription?
So the Bliss Prescription is a systematic way of discovering bliss, you know. And so we have to first define what bliss means, I guess, just for clarity's sake. Because it's a word that is so misused and overused and means different things to different people. But here, bliss actually refers to that thing that we are all seeking in whatever way that we are seeking it. You know, it is that contentment and fulfillment and that resting of that constant energy to have more, do more, and because we are always, that comes from a place of lack, and that comes from a place of lack because it comes from a place of identification with the mind and body. As we start to think that the mind is and this body is really who we are, but actually who we are is eternal bliss consciousness. So when we move from that identity of a limited being to the eternal bliss consciousness, then, you know, then that sense of lack falls away. So our nature, our very nature, our very identity is bliss, which is not a slap, happy, ecstatic kind of a thing, but it's the sweet resting and sweet contentment. And that includes like the whole, you know, it's not just limited to me, to my family, to my community, but it just radiates out to encompass everyone and everything.
Yeah. Now, yeah. In the bliss model aspect, you talked about the bliss consciousness as being a part of or the substance of everything, animate and inanimate as well. So, I mean, it seems that it's this, it's kind of like a universal energy, I guess, of sorts that would be a part of everything.
Yes. Yeah. One way to think of it as is like a universal energy, but it may not be you know, it may not even be like an energetic experience. It's more of a knowing, you know, it's more of that awareness, of that consciousness,
okay.
which may not have, you know, may or may not have energy going on with it.
Okay, I understand. So, and in your book, you do talk a lot about awareness, you know, raising awareness and how, and in the model, kind of how bliss consciousness feeds into creating the material. And I mean, it's a wonderful model. But with that, you also talk about a default model. So, you know, because, I mean, there is this, desire, to get to the knowing of this state of being, this blissful state of being, and then there's a default. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, for some people, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's easier to understand models if you can kind of compare to what is happening versus what the goal is.
Yeah. And so the default mode is, or the default model is really the one that all of us really operate from, you know, for the most part, which is being identified as this person with this story and with this history and with this upbringing and with, you know, whatever it is that we think we are, you know, the one that likes this and doesn't like that and has this history and has these roles as a, you know, wife, husband, mother, father, son, daughter, whatever it may be, we become identified as that. And so that when that identification happens, because we, our true nature is, you know, unlimited, eternal bliss consciousness, that identification always comes with a sense of lack, because deep down, each of us has the intuition that there is something greater. And so in the default model, everything that we do serves that individual person with, you know, in medicine, you are your mind and body. You know, you are your body first and foremost. So if you have that disease, it's happening to you. If you have a problem, then it's happening to you. So that is the model that we operate from. Whereas the bliss model actually talks about this body and mind being only one part of who we really are. So it is much more expansive and says, well, it's not even limited to this mind, this spirit, this individual story. Can we actually discover that? Can we discover our true nature, where this identification as this body mind with this story loosens, and we are able to take a stand as awareness, as this consciousness that happens to be who we really are? And then what happens to our experience? So the very paradigm is different between the two models. You know, in the default model, you are your mind and body. In the bliss model, you are bliss and you just don't know it. So we need to work through that. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, and again, I just think that once we, you know, kind of have an idea, I mean, because we really operate in the default mode model, from day one, we really kind of create this identity or this, you know, this perception, you know, of who we are, you know, based on, you know, all kinds of variables. But one of the things in your book, you talk about, you know, pathways, you know, and I think in the default model, you know, we react, you know, to circumstances in a certain way, you know, and those pathways are, and I looked and when I read it, that most pathways are formed by the age of 7, and then even called superhighways, you know, for those super duper pathways. You know, I just thought that it was just amazing that, you know, that by age 7, those pathways are established. And so basically this default model has a really great, strong start by age of 7, correct?
Absolutely. And you know, it's a very innocently procured kind of a thing. Because, you know, right when it's not something that we are born with. You know, when we are born, we actually cannot find a separation between ourselves and the mother. Like, you know, there is no separation between the world and me and the mother. It's all one big amorphous kind of a, you know, experience. But as the child grows, you know, we give the child a name, and then right around, you know, the age of 2 is when, you know, the language capability develops, and then, you know, we point to the child and say, you are so-and-so, and I'm so-and-so. And you see that separation is created. That's when, you know, this is mine, this is me. The terrible twos actually begin with that understanding that I'm different. I'm very unique compared to everybody else. And this is mine, and that's not mine. This is me, that's not me. And so that separation actually happens very innocently because we are all universally conditioned like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and like you say, you know, it's very innocent, and but now the question that I have is that, you know, well, first of all, one of the things that you mentioned in the book in the mind-body connection section was that recent research has shown that, you know, new neurons can be formed well into old age. So, I mean, these new connections can happen well into old age, which is great for those of us that are kind of up there, you know, to recognize that this can happen. So the question is with knowing that is still possible, does the changing and altering of those pathways and those superhighways, especially the superhighways that have been ingrained for so long, that basically says then they can change the path. Pathways can change, correct?
Yes, the pathways can change, and so that's that gives a lot of hope, right? That we are not really, we don't have to be stuck in the same old kind of patterns. You know, that we can form new patterns, and that takes work, but it's doable. You know, and so you can, and that comes with this willingness where, you know, if I'm really stuck in my ways and say no, this is how I do this, and this is how I've always thought I'm going to do it, then there's nothing you can do about that. But if you say, well, I'm willing to learn something new, then those new pathways can be facilitated.
Okay, so now, okay, being open to the change and that different perspective, and then I'm assuming then it's reacting differently to situations that would be the key to create the new pathway?
Yes, and choosing the response. You know, this is the thing is, you bring up a really good point, is, you know, most of us, you know, these super highways are formed because we respond the same way to the same stimulus. Okay, so if there's something I don't like, I've developed an aversion for something, then it doesn't really take a whole lot of, you know, a whole lot of instances of being stimulated by it for my aversion to create certain pathways. And so every time I see this object or this person or this situation, I get triggered. And That forms a highway, and the brain learns very fast, you know, our system learns very fast. Well, if this is going to be the reaction every single time, let me just form a super highway around that so that it's easier to form this reaction every single time. So you see, it becomes very habitual for us to react and to do things, and we kind of make that our identity. And when we say, oh, I'm not a person who likes that, or I'm not a person who you can stand that, I like this and I don't like that. And you see, we are just allowing those super highways to dictate who we think we are. But actually, between the stimulus and a response, there is a gap where we can choose something different. And that's how we retrain our systems, by choosing something different.
Okay, so the key then would be the awareness of the trigger, of being triggered, you know, into a response, being aware of the situation kind of happening, then making the conscious choice to react differently.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, it seems easy when we talk about it, but actually when you're in the thick of things, it's very hard.
Yeah. Well, that's why the superhighway was created, to make it easy.
Exactly. So, you know, it's very, very difficult. You know, you're driving along and, you know, and then somebody cuts you off and that's the rage just pounds through your system, right? And before you know it, it's those hormones have been secreted. The, you know, the contractions have happened. It's not even like a conscious thing, right? And so to remain conscious through those kinds of things, we need to develop the ability to, we just need to be able to develop a quiet inner environment. So that inner silence is very, very important. If the mind is always chatty and chattering and going a, you know, a mile a minute, then it's really impossible to catch these gaps between stimulus and response, which is why, you know, I always recommend meditation as the foundational thing for everything I do in my programs and in my work with people. When you have a long-term established meditation practice, then you create that distance between stimulus and response. You can catch that gap in which that response can happen more and more and more easily.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you indicate that not all meditation is equal, right? I mean, there are different types for different goals.
Yes, there are different types of meditation for different things. So, you know, you know, there research has shown that as well. So that happens to be the case, actually.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the one thing that I mean, as I was going through and reading, I thought, because I always thought that meditation, you know, was basically all the same. And that, but what you get in the book, you get into the different types of wavelengths and states, you know, that each one is, and what I found very, very interesting. Now, one of the chapters in your book is called The Stress Cauldron. And, you know, stress is everywhere. I mean, you know, some people just seem to live in stress. Now, is there truly something good stress and bad stress, or is all stress not healthy?
Well, you know, there is a lot about, you know, there is a lot of literature on good stress, or what is known as eustress. And I think I touched on that a little bit in the book, not a whole lot. But, you know, people think that stress is necessary for performance. And I'm not so sure about that, because ultimately the body doesn't really care whether it's good or bad. It's only seeing the hormones, you know. It's only seeing the cellular effects of everything that is produced. So if it is good stress or bad stress, and there's a lot of cortisol produced in the name of good stress, it doesn't really matter for the body. You know, what we are, so in order to understand this, we have to understand that the body doesn't really care what we think or, you know, we should be doing with our lives. You know, as far as the body is concerned, it has, you know, a certain amount of energy that it can expend, a certain amount of energy it takes in, a certain amount of energy it expends, all these functions that it needs to perform, and that's that. And then it needs to preserve, the fundamental issues of survival. It needs to survive, and it needs to be able to reproduce. Most basic things in biology, you know, so the body doesn't really have the ability to care, you know, how we feel about ourselves and how we are going about our lives, our sense of self-worth and not, and it just doesn't care. It doesn't have the ability to do that. So all it can do is it just takes in the information, produces you know, these various chemicals, and these chemicals go to work. That's it. Very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about good stress or bad stress, the body doesn't have the ability to differentiate between the two and
right.
say, well, you know, she really needs to get this deadline. So let me not produce this cortisol. It has no ability to do that, you know? So it's just
mm-hmm.
going to see that and do what it's going to do. And
right.
This is one thing that's very important to understand and kind of separate, that it's all biological. It's not personal. You know, the body doesn't have the ability to take things personally. Only the mind does.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's basically a machine with a lot of different operating systems, you know, and kind of what you feed in and according to its structure and responses, it responds. I mean, it responds to, you know, what is input into it.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's very, very simple. And if you look at it like a computer or look at it like a very basic biological structure, it just it keeps things very simple. You know, it's, I have a lot of patients, for instance, who come and tell me, you know, I'm really trying to make a change in my diet or in my lifestyle. And
mm-hmm.
And I tell them, well, you know, I don't know what to tell you. If you're trying makes no difference to the body. You know, your body's
right.
not going to say, let me, well, he's really trying, so let me not have a heart attack. You know?
Right.
So
we'll go easy on him because he's trying.
Yeah, so it just simply doesn't have the ability to
right.
care whether or not you are trying. And it's just biology. So,
yeah,
so that's my take on stress.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it was interesting. I mean, when you talked about, you know, the person trying to do better, one of the, I think it was even in the introduction in your book, you had a story, an example of someone who came to you who did, quote, everything right. In her mind, you know, she ate right, exercised, did all of this stuff right. And then had breast cancer, and then she had siblings who weren't doing things right
yeah.
and didn't, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean, that really struck me because I just had one of my neighbors die this morning, and he was one of those who, quote, did everything right, didn't smoke, didn't drink, you know. As far as exercise, he didn't really do formal exercise, but he was, like, on the go all the time, worked until he was 80 years old.
Oh, wow.
And ate properly all the time, and he died of cancer. So, I mean, and that was, you know, this morning, and I thought, you know, I mean, this is one of those things where it's just, odd, you know, that, you know, we have this, I mean, we want to, you know, do our best, you know, to keep our body, you know, in tip-top shape, you know, or best working order possible. And even if we do that, there are sometimes circumstances where, you know, disease happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's the whole perspective, you know, which is, and this is, you know, this is a stark contrast between the Western and Eastern perspectives. In the Eastern perspective, death is part of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, death and disease and decay, they're all part of life. It's a cycle that goes on because we are looking at the whole. And, but here in the West, there's this very irrational fear of death. You know, it's like it's very
mm-hmm.
sterile, very removed from life. And everybody is trying to, you know, find a cure for death. There isn't one. You know, there is no cure for death.
Exactly.
Right?
We're all going to experience it sometime. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I tell my patients all the time that it's a two-way ticket. You know, we come with a two-way ticket, and you have to keep everything in perspective, and that you can do everything right, but your body is going to decay, and right. It's just part of life, and so that whole, you know, that stance is it is that default model that we were talking about earlier.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and knowing my neighbor as I did, he operated from default purely, from default to default mode. You know, and then there's no judgment in that. It's just that it was one of those, that was, you know, those were the choices that he made throughout his life. You know, I mean, and what he would really constantly defer to those super highway reactions, you know, of life,
yeah.
You know. And so, you know, when I found out about the diagnosis, I wasn't surprised because to me, it kind of fit in with, you know, a life experience for him, you know, and then hopefully, you know, prior to transitioning, hopefully he got a little bit more awareness. I think he did, but it was just one of those things. It was, you know, to me, it just played out. It just seemed like it played out as it was supposed to play out. You know, that he lived and lived with his choices, and his choices led to that, you know, that diagnosis, and then of course, you know, it was rather quick, you know, and which would have been something he would have wanted, you know. So I mean, to me, it was pretty much like a finely scripted play, you know, that really
yeah.
kind of played out, you know, to the end.
Yeah, and you know, it's. That's such a beautiful story because it ultimately, you know, life is extremely kind and benevolent. And what I mean by that is that at every given moment, life is giving us opportunities to wake up. You know, to wake up to what? To wake up to this, our true nature. Because it's saying, hey, you think you are limited to this body. You're not. Why don't you wake up and see really who you are? So life is always giving us opportunities, and disease
mm-hmm.
is one of those opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, and so because you know, when I see my patients, I tell them, for instance, they've survived a heart attack or they've survived you know, a stroke or some kind of an event, and it's you know, a few of them are transformed by that event. You know, their
mm-hmm.
life has changed. Their perspective has changed because they have taken up life on that. You know, they've taken up life's challenge and said, okay, now is my chance to wake up. And as long as we are not doing that, our life will keep giving us opportunities, whether it is being cut off on the highway or being, you know, diagnosed with a disease. It doesn't matter. Life is always giving us opportunities. It's so kind and benevolent and sweet like that.
Yes, I agree. Well, I want to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask any questions, you can dial 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in. And then when we come back, Dr. Shania, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, part two of your book. Part one was about kind of understanding cause and effect and risk and that kind of thing regarding illness and disease. But part two of it is the Bliss prescription program. So I'd like to come back and talk a little bit about that, okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Dr. Kavitha Shanayan, and we are talking about her new book, The Heart of Wellness, Bridging Western and Eastern Medicine to Transform Your Relationship with Habits, Lifestyle, and Health. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is KavithaMD.com, and that's KavithaMD.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Dr. Shanayan.
Hi.
Hi there. Okay, so part two of your book, and one of the things I like about your book is the application, the ability to apply what you teach us, reading, to our lives and be able to kind of make changes, you know, raise our awareness. And so part two of your book is the Bliss Prescription Program. Can you talk a little bit about the program and kind of what it consists of?
Yeah, so I like to think of this program as an outside-in and an inside-out approach. And what I mean by that is, you know, the first step in this program is actually about kindling the digestive fire. And when I talk about the digestive fire, you know, most of us think of digestion as that which occurs in the body. That's only one part of digestion. Digestion also refers to how we process information, how we process sensory perception, our past experiences, our ability to let go of things, our ability to forgive and move on. And all of that is part of this digestive process from the Ayurvedic perspective. So we work on digestion in very specific lifestyle lifestyle kind of applications. So we work with the circadian rhythm, you know, work with the routine of the day by keeping a very regular routine, by eating certain kinds of foods, and so on. And then that's the outside-in part of it. And then, you know, there's also the decluttering. That's one of the steps of the program, which is both outside in and inside out, where we actually declutter not just our physical space. And anybody who has decluttered their physical space can attest to how freeing that is. When we hang on to things from the past that no longer serve us, then that sets us up for this, you know, hanging on to our superhighways. So decluttering both the physical environment, of course, but also decluttering our minds. Very, very important, decluttering our relationships and our time and our space and our minds. All of those things are part of the prescription. And for the purely inside-out process, you know, we work through meditation, and then we work through specific breath practices, and then we work through, very importantly, towards the end of the book, once we have, you know, once we are established in meditation and these other practices, then we are able to move on to some of the advanced practices, which is, you know, finding bliss in the body and working with pain, working with trauma, working with, you know, addictions and those kinds of things, which can't happen if we don't have a good, committed meditation platform.
Yeah. a couple of the digestive areas. The one eating for bliss, eat for bliss is one of the sections. In that, what impressed me in that section, first of all, you do have some recipes in there.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to trying them. but what's really, what I found really interesting, it was the approach that you had was like, you know, not to make this a religion, not to make this a diet, but I mean, you really approach the idea of our nourishment, you know, our food nourishment from a well-rounded, you know, approach. I mean, it's, you know, kind of being body aware of what the body needs and supplying the body what it needs.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't like being on a diet, do you?
No.
I don't like to be told.
I haven't found one that works.
Yeah, but you know, once we kind of understand our bodies and begin to work from a place of love, see, that is the difference between a diet and this kind of an approach. Because a diet, with all its restrictions, comes from a place of, if you eat that, you're going to get that. You know, if that is harmful, that's going to cause a disease. It comes from a place of resistance and fear. But once we actually learn to love our bodies, and we are doing this because we love our bodies, we love this whole process, then you kind of, the body itself gives in and starts giving you clues about what it wants. And, you know, of course, there's this whole movement of intuitive eating, which is beautiful. But it also takes a finesse and, you know, practice to understand even what the body is asking for. Because, you know, we can confuse our superhighways for what the body wants. No, your body doesn't want that huge piece of chocolate cake right now. Right?
Even though you've done it for years.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And because we confuse our likes and dislikes with what the body needs, that kind of intuitive kind of eating takes time to master. You know, it takes time and practice to actually apply that. So in the meantime, though, you can work on very, very simple principles that, you know, as long as we understand what the foods actually do to us. You know, it's like, you know, you have a lot of coffee, you're always agitated and stimulated, and plus those hormonal pathways are going berserk. And you can see that, you know, once you are able to cultivate a little bit of inner silence, you can actually see that within yourself. So, okay, so I won't have so much. I won't have that because I want to experience this. You know, I want to experience what happens if I don't have that. So you see how that comes from this gradual, very sweet and loving way of breaking through, you know, our very calcified and crystallized pathways.
Yeah, I know that, you know, since I've started paying attention to food and how I feel afterwards, you know, I recognize that. I mean, there are certain times I'll have certain foods and I'll just be lethargic afterwards. Like, you know,
yeah.
I just don't like it. I mean, you know, and then there'll be times I'll be energetic. It's like, okay, I'd rather have that, you know, than sitting around laying on the couch afterwards, not feeling good. So that, you know, ever since I've done that, I try. No, I do as much as I can to include those that are healthy. So, but I think that's the key, is just recognizing how your body reacts to certain foods. And adjusting accordingly.
Yes. Yeah. And in this program, you know, there are specific things that I say to avoid, and that is really working through the principles of Ayurveda and, you know, why that is harmful for the digestive fire and how certain things actually facilitate that strengthening and balancing of digestion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, one of the things as a part of the Bliss Prescription Program that I thought was going to be a little bit difficult for some of the listeners or readers would be how important it is to get out of the instant gratification mindset. I think there are a lot of folks there. I want to check and see who responded to my post. What's the latest reaction on this? Instant gratification has really permeated our society.
Oh my gosh, yes, it's ingrained into this society, isn't it? It's not uncommon for me to have patients say to me, "I don't think I can do all this lifestyle thing. Just give me a pill. Yeah, I'll be done." Because then I can see who wants to put in so much work, right? I'd rather just do that. So that attitude is actually part of the problem. And this patient loving way of cultivating things is actually a very lost art in modern society, and that's where these superhighways become more and more calcified, and really become deep trenches where they're very hard to overcome. So but it's possible to overcome.
It's a matter of choosing differently. I mean, recognizing there's a choice and choosing differently. And so in a way, it's simple, choose differently, but it can be a challenge sometimes to recognize and act differently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I say in the book. It's very simple, but simple doesn't mean easy.
Exactly.
Because it takes a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So we're getting down to the end of the show, but there is one thing that I would love for you to talk a little bit about, and it was toward one of the final sections called Find Bliss in the Body. And in that one, you have an exercise called Finding Space in the Body.
Yeah.
And I thought, I went through and, read the exercises, and I thought, out of all of the exercises, I thought this one was completely new to me. It's something that I never really thought about, is finding space in the body. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's unique.
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you really think about it, space is the predominant thing in all of creation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at even an atom, most of the atom is space.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
right.
just this electron, the proton, and then the quarks, whatever. But most of it is space. So it may seem very solid. The table may seem very solid, but actually if you zoom into it, you'll see only these space. If you really zoom in, keep zooming in, it's only space. And so it is with our bodies too. It's space. It feels very solid, it feels very heavy and solid and so on. But actually, our body is mostly space. And it's such a novel thing, for most of us. It's like, what? I don't feel like that, if it is space and I should be flying. So, but it's not like that, it's the paradox of creation that there is space and yet there is heaviness. And that comes from this whole bliss model that I explained early on, which is the five elements and how it permeates through that and so on. If you understand that, then this issue of space becomes very easy to access with enough practice. And so I lead people through these exercises, for instance, in my classes. And it's absolutely beautiful, to be able to find that space. And then when you fall back into the spaciousness within your body, then the aches and pains and the perceptions seem very different. And they take on a very different light, shimmery and a very beautiful quality. So the resistance melts from I don't want that to what is that, so it's it's a beautiful exercise.
Yeah, I thought so too, and again, that's one of those areas we rarely focus on because we're so attuned to the dense, you know, the dense part of life, you know, that we really, and you know, it, to me, you know, when I sat down and did the exercise, it just, it felt very freeing. I mean, you know, you kind of, in a way, meld with, you know, everything else that is spacious.
Yes. And then you kind of, you know, as you work with these kinds of practices, then the space here starts to meld into the space there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So the space within and without, there are no boundaries actually to space, you know? So that kind of starts melding, and the implications there are huge. You know, the way we start looking at the world changes. The way we start looking at ourselves changes. Everything changes with that, you know, with that kind of a perspective. Does that make sense?
I agree. Oh, yeah, very much so. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the, you know, day-to-day challenges, stresses, they kind of become insignificant in a way, you know,
yeah.
when you get down to, you know, looking at, you know, why you're here, what you're doing. Dr. Shania, this has really been great. Before we go, what is it that you hope that the reader is going to take away from reading The Heart of Wellness?
Well, I hope the reader is going to take away the fundamental thing that, you know, we are, that number one, suffering is optional. It doesn't matter your state of health or disease. Suffering is always in our hands, and it's optional, and it's not predetermined. And perhaps give the reader a different vantage point to view themselves and the world from.
Yeah. Well, it did it for me. So, I mean, you know, and again, I really liked the exercises that accompanied, you know, various sections that kind of made it very personal and poignant, you know, and practical. So I just really want to thank you for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you today.
Oh, I did too. Thank you so much. It's been so fun talking with you.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, today, everyone, my very special guest has been Dr. Kavitha Shania. We've been talking about her book, The Heart of Wellness, Bridging Western and Eastern Medicine to Transform Your Relationship with Habits, Lifestyle, and Health. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is kavithamd.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So everyone, until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.